day or night, VerboCare is here 24/7 to help make every part of your stay seamless. If anything comes up, or you simply need a little guidance, support is ready whenever you reach out. From the moment you book to the moment you head home, we're here to help things run smoothly. Because a great trip starts with the right support. And hey, a good playlist doesn't hurt either.
Hi, I'm Daniel Lickage.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music itself. And like and I can enter the music industry. The architect of in-between. How Bob Weir's rhythm guitar save the live Grateful Dead R.I.P.
Yes, the passing of Bob Weir on January 10, 2026 at age 78 marks the end of an extraordinary six-decade journey through American music. As co-founder and rhythm guitarist of the Grateful Dead, Weir helped architect the psychedelic rock movement, became the tireless steward of one of rock's most enduring legacies. Weir was renowned as a permanent fixture, like a river or a mountain that would always be there. This episode explores how a dyslexic kid expelled from nearly every school became one of rock's most innovative rhythm players, a prolific songwriter, and the driving force who kept the Grateful Dead's music alive for three decades after Jerry Garcia's death.
Interesting, Mr. Mike. Interesting indeed. Bob Weir, just 16 years old, when he co-founded what we become, the Grateful Dead. How did someone so young end up with the center of one rock's most important bands?
Well, Bob Weir's path to rock stardom began with a series of challenges that might have derailed a less determined person. Born in San Francisco in 1947 to college student parents who gave him up for adoption, Weir suffered from an undiagnosed dyslexia and behavioral issues that saw him expelled from almost every school he attended. For a time, he was sent to a school in Colorado specifically for boys with behavioral problems. But young Bobby found his salvation in two places, athletics and music. Inspired by a nanny's jazz record collection, he experimented with piano and trumpet before settling on guitar at 13. Under the tutelage of Jefferson Airplane's Jorma Kaukinen, he gravitated toward bluegrass, the genre that would lead him straight to his destiny. The meeting that changed everything happened on New Year's Eve, 1963. 16-year-old Weir was wandering the streets of Palo Alto looking for a club that would admit someone underage when he heard banjo music drifting from Dana Morgan's music store. Inside, he found Jerry Garcia, and the two played together all night. By morning, they decided to form a band they called Mother McCree's Uptown Jug Champions. It was the beginning of a musical partnership that would reshape American culture. Originally conceived as a jug band, the group was inspired to shift toward rock and roll by the Beatles' explosive success. By 1965, they'd evolved to the name The Warlocks before settling on Grateful Dead, just as the San Francisco counterculture scene was desperately seeking local acts to champion. Their timing couldn't have been better. The Dead's first performance in December 1965 took place at one of Ken Kesey's infamous acid tests in San Jose, where attendees consumed LSD supplied by chemist Owsley Stanley, while the band provided the soundtrack. The Dead became something of a house band for these events, also playing at the legendary 1966 psychedelic rock weekender called Trips. Stanley himself became their financial backer, cementing the band's role at the absolute epicenter of the emerging counterculture. At these events, Weir and his bandmates, bassist Phil Lish, drummer Bill Kreutzmann, and keyboardist Ron Pigpen McKernan, developed the improvisational style that would define their entire career. They cultivated what Weir had later described as speaking a language that nobody else speaks, achieving an almost telepathic musical connection. Lesh famously characterized Weir's rhythm guitar work as quirky, whimsical, and goofy, high praise from one of rock's most unconventional bassists. Even at 16, Weir wasn't just keeping rhythm. He was inventing new ways to think about what rhythm guitar could be. In conclusion, Weir's improbable journey from troubled teen to teenage rock pioneer set the template for his entire career, overcoming obstacles through sheer determination, finding unconventional solutions to musical challenges, and helping build something far greater and larger than himself.
Mr. Mack, Weir wrote or co-wrote some of the Grateful Dead's most beloved songs. What made tracks like Sugar Magnolia, Truckin', and Playing in the Band so special, and how did they contribute to the band's massive appeal?
While Jerry Garcia and lyricist Robert Hunter created what many consider the bedrock of the Grateful Dead's catalog, Bob Weir crafted an equally formidable body of work, often under the considerable shadow cast by Garcia's genius. Working primarily with lyricist John Perry Barlow, Weir penned songs that became central text in the language deadheads learned to speak. These weren't just tracks on albums. They were vehicles for exploration, mantras for a community, and showcases for Weir's distinctive conversational voice. Written with Barlow, this ebullient and salt love song captured the optimistic, romantic spirit of the counterculture at its peak. The tune became a concert staple, typically appearing in the second set and often seamlessly flowing into the coda, Sunshine Daydream. And with this, what makes the song remarkable is its structural sophistication hidden beneath accessible melody. The chord changes are far more complex than they initially appear, and Weir's rhythm work creates a buoyant foundation that perfectly complements the lyrics' celebration of romantic and natural beauty. Truckin' represents the Dead's only legitimate hit single, although calling it a hit requires qualification. The autobiographical tune, co-written with Garcia, Lesh, and Hunter, appeared on the double platinum American Beauty album and captured the band's touring lifestyle with remarkable honesty. The famous lyric, "What a long, strange trip it's been," became the de facto motto for the entire generation. While the band would score their highest charting single years later with 1987's Touch of Grey, which gave them their only top 10 hit, Truckin' remains the song most associated with the Dead's journey through American culture. Its blend of country rock accessibility and literary complexity exemplified the Dead at their most commercially palatable without sacrificing artistic integrity. Playing in the Band showcases Weir's most adventurous compositional instincts. The song became one of the Dead's primary vehicles for extended improvisation, often stretching to 20 or 30 minutes in live performance. The structure allowed the band to venture into completely uncharted territory before finding their way back to the main theme, a perfect metaphor for the Dead's entire aesthetic philosophy. The song's modal foundation and open-ended middle sections gave Garcia, Lesh, and the drummers room to explore, while Weir's rhythm work provided just enough harmonic information to keep everyone oriented. Other Weir compositions became equally central to the Dead's identity. Cassidy, written about Neil Cassidy's death and birth of Barlow's daughter, combined mourning and celebration in ways that resonated deeply with fans facing their own losses. Estimated Prophet, with its reggae-influenced rhythm and lyrics channeling religious zealotry, gave Weir a showcase for his increasingly sophisticated vocal work. The Other One, an early composition that morphed and evolved over decades, became a...
My name is Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
The launching pad for some of the Dead's most intense improvisations. And One More Saturday Night became the traditional show closer, sending audiences into the parking lot on a wave of communal joy. What distinguished Weir's songs from Garcia's was their structural boldness and rhythmic complexity. While Garcia favored folk-influenced melodies and storytelling lyrics, Weir embraced more adventurous harmonic territory and asymmetrical song structures. His compositions often featured unusual time signatures, unexpected chord progressions, and arrangements that challenged both performers and listeners. Yet somehow these songs also became crowd favorites, proving that accessibility and sophistication aren't mutually exclusive. In conclusion, Weir's songwriting catalog demonstrates that he wasn't merely Garcia's sidekick, but a composer with his own distinctive voice, one that pushed the dead toward greater musical adventure while creating songs that fans cherished as deeply as any in the band's repertoire.
Interesting, Mr. Mank, and with both Bob Dylan and John Mayer have praised Weir's unorthodox approach to rhythm guitar. What made this playing style so distinctive, and where did it come from?
Bob Weir's rhythm work guitar work stands as one of rock's most distinctive and misunderstood achievements. Unlike most rock guitarists who learn by emulating other guitarists, Weir developed his approach by studying jazz piano, specifically the work of McCoy Tyner in the John Coltrane Quartet. This unusual source of inspiration led him to a playing style that Dylan aptly described as very unorthodox, comparing it to Joni Mitchell's approach, but from a different place. Weir himself explained the genesis of his style with characteristic modesty. At the age of 17, I listened to the John Coltrane Quartet, focusing on McCoy Tyner's work, feeding Coltrane harmonic and rhythmic ideas to springboard off of, and I developed an approach to guitar playing based off it. Weir later told journalist Alan Paul, "My dirty little secret is that I learned by trying to imitate a piano. That caught my ear and lit my flame." What did this mean in practice? Weir's approach created a harmonic landscape where the fundamental information often emerged from the space between the instruments rather than any single player. Consider the studio recording of Scarlet Begonias from the album From the Mars Hotel. How listen to how Weir finds pockets in the rhythm and offers chord stabs, slides, and slurs in counterpoint to Garcia, Lesh, and the drums. This approach created unique challenges and opportunities for Garcia, whose lead work had to navigate the unconventional harmonic territory Weir established. The two guitarists developed an almost telepathic understanding, with Garcia's lead lines weaving through the spaces Weir's chords created. John Mayer, who spent nearly a decade playing alongside Weir in Dead & Company, understood the sophistication beneath what might sound casual. Surface listeners might miss the complexity, but musicians who dug what he was actually doing found a masterclass in sophisticated rhythm work. Weir wrote, "Igor Stravinsky's work wasn't news to me at that point, but what he did and how he did it were ongoing topics of discussion for Phil Lesh and I, and boy, did I ever grow." The incorporation of 20th century classical music's harmonic and rhythmic innovations into rock guitar created something entirely new. In conclusion, Weir's rhythm guitar style represents one of rock's most significant innovations, a complete reimagining of what rhythm guitar could be, informed by jazz and classical music rather than blues rock tradition, creating counterpoint rather than simple support, and opening up harmonic spaces that his bandmates could explore with extraordinary freedom.
Mr. Mink, the Grateful Dead released 22 studio albums over the three decades, with only one top 10 single, yet they become one of America's most successful touring acts. How did albums like Working Man's Dead or American Beauty and In the Dark contribute to that paradox?
The Grateful Dead's relationship with recorded music exemplifies rock's most fascinating paradox, a band whose studio albums regularly charted but whose true power resided in live performance. Their catalog spans from early experimental psychedelia through country rock reinvention to 1980s commercial success, yet Deadheads always understood that albums represented merely snapshots of an ever-evolving live experience. Still, several studio releases crystallized the band's vision and introduced new audiences to their world. Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, both released in 1970, marked the Dead's decisive shift from extended psychedelic improvisation toward Americana and country rock songcraft. These albums, recorded in rapid succession, featured Weir prominently as both vocalist and rhythm guitarist, his playing anchoring the more structured arrangements. American Beauty eventually achieved double platinum status, proving the commercial viability of the Dead's most accessible side. Songs like Truckin', Sugar Magnolia, and Garcia's Friend of the Devil became FM radio staples. What made these albums significant wasn't just their commercial success, but how they demonstrated the Dead's versatility. The Dead's highest charting album came in 1987 with In the Dark, featuring their only legitimate hit single, Touch of Grey. By this point, the band had survived member deaths, drug problems, and Garcia's near-fatal diabetic coma in 1986. The success of In the Dark and Touch of Grey, which reached number 9 on the Billboard Hot 100, introduced the Dead to MTV generation audiences and proved their continuing relevance. Throughout the 1970s and 1980s, the Dead albums regularly reached the U.S. top 30, even without hit singles driving sales. This unusual success pattern reflected their devoted fan base loyalty and the band's practice of allowing fans to freely tape and trade concert recordings. While conventional wisdom suggested that free live recordings would cannibalize album sales, the Dead proved the opposite. The more people heard them live, the more they wanted to support the band through album purchases and concert attendance. Weir's solo albums, Ace 1972, Heaven Help the Fool 1978, and his final release, Blue Mountain 2016, demonstrated his versatility outside the Dead context, though none achieved the commercial impact of the main band's work. The albums also documented the Dead's personnel changes, particularly the succession of keyboardists who replaced founding member Ron Pigpen McKernan after he died in 1973. Each new member, Keith Kodrow, Brent Midland, and later Vince Welnick and Bruce Hornsby, brought different flavors to the band's sound. In conclusion, the Grateful Dead studio album served dual purposes, introducing new listeners to the band's musical vision while providing Deadheads with relatively fixed versions of songs they'd heard mutate and evolve across hundreds of performances, a paradox that perfectly captured the band's unique position in rock history.
Measure Mank, despite having only one hit single, The Grateful Dead become America's highest grossing touring act. How did they build such a massive and devoted following?
The Grateful Dead's live performance history represents one of rock's most remarkable achievements, building and sustaining America's most devoted fan base through sheer commitment to the concert experience. Over three decades, they developed a business model that upended music industry conventions, proving that artistic integrity and commercial success weren't mutually exclusive. The Dead's touring success began with a radical decision. They allowed, even encouraged, fans to tape their concerts and freely trade recordings. This practice, which conventional industry wisdom suggested would hurt ticket sales, instead created a vast community of collectors and traders. Concerts themselves were immersive experiences, often stretching to 4 hours with individual songs lasting 30 to 45 minutes. The Dead rarely played the same set list twice, varying arrangements and extending improvisations based on the moment's energy. The band's peak touring year, 1977, demonstrated their draw. Their show at Raceway Park in New Jersey attracted 107,000 fans, holding the record for America's largest ticketed concert until 2024. The Dead played between 70 and 100 shows annually during their peak years, building a circuit of venues where they could count on selling out multiple nightstands. This reliability made them a favorite of promoters and venue operators who knew Dead shows would generate substantial revenue not just from tickets, but from the carnival-like atmosphere Deadheads created in parking lots before and after performances. The community that formed around the Dead became as important as the music itself. The parking lot scene, dubbed Shakedown Street, after a Dead song, featured vendors selling food, tie-dyed clothing, and bootleg recordings. Weir's presence was crucial to this touring machine's success. The Dead's touring success created a template that jam bands still follow today. The model proved so durable that Dead & Company, the iteration featuring Weir and original drummer Mickey Hart, alongside younger musicians like John Mayer, became one of the highest-grossing touring acts of the 2010s and 2020s. In conclusion, a Grateful Dead's touring phenomenon rested on a foundation of mutual respect between band and audience, relentless work ethic, particularly from Weir, and a business model that prioritized long-term fan base cultivation over short-term profit maximization, creating a sustainable touring operation that outdated most of their contemporaries.
Mr. Mick, the Jerry's Garcia's death in 1995 could have ended the Grateful Dead story, but Bob Weir spent the next three decades keeping the music alive. How did he manage this, and what did it mean for the band's legacy?
When Jerry Garcia died on August 9, 1995, many assumed the Grateful Dead story had ended. Garcia had been the band's reluctant leader, its most iconic member, and for many fans, its irreplaceable heart. Yet Bob Weir, just 47 years old, faced a choice: let the music fade into history or find ways to keep it alive without the man who'd co-founded the band with him 30 years earlier. Weir chose the latter path, spending three decades becoming the principal steward of the Dead's legacy. Not everyone approved of Weir's decision. He formed new bands that honored the material while exploring different approaches. His first post-Dead project, Rat Dog, formed in 1995, featured younger musicians and reworked Dead classics with a looser, more rock-oriented sound. Reunion projects offered different opportunities. The Other Ones, formed in 1998, reunited Weir with surviving Dead members Phil Lesh, Mickey Hart, and Bill Kreutzmann, adding various guest musicians to fill Garcia's impossible-to-fill role. Further, Weir also formed with Lesh in 2009, represented another approach. The most significant post-Garcia project came in 2015 when Weir, Hart, and Kreutzmann reunited with Lesh for the Fare Thee Well concerts at Chicago's Soldier Field, celebrating the Dead's 50th anniversary. These shows, which also featured Phish's Trey Anastasio and keyboardist Bruce Hornsby, were billed as the final performances by the surviving Core Four. Yet Weir wasn't finished. Later in 2015, he formed Dead & Company with Hart, Kreutzmann, and surprisingly, John Mayer, the pop rock guitarist two generations younger than the Dead's founders. Many doubted this pairing could work, but Mayer proved himself a student of Garcia's playing and a perfect foil for Weir's rhythmic work. Dead & Company became one of America's highest-grossing tour acts, playing sold-out stadium shows annually through 2023 and proving that Dead music could speak to audiences who weren't even born when Garcia died. The 2024 Sphere residency represented the culmination of Weir's stewardship. Playing 30 shows at Las Vegas's state-of-the-art venue, Dead & Company used cutting-edge visual technology to create immersive experiences that enhanced rather than overshadowed the music. The final performance came in summer 2025 at San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, celebrating the Grateful Dead's 60th anniversary, where the story had begun six decades earlier. Throughout these post-Garcia decades, Weir also explored other musical avenues. His Wolf Brothers trio, formed with bassist Don Was and drummer Jay Lane in 2018, started as a stripped-down acoustic project but evolved into a 10-piece ensemble with strings, horns, keys, and pedal steel. These shows reworked Dead classics in radically different arrangements, demonstrating that these songs could sustain endless reinterpretation. In conclusion, Bob Weir's three decades of post-Garcia stewardship ensured the Grateful Dead's music remained a living tradition rather than a historical artifact.
Mr. Mick, throughout his career, Bob Weir showed a remarkable willingness to experiment and evolve. What characterized his artistic fearlessness, and how did it manifest across different projects?
One of Bob Weir's most enduring and significant qualities was what journalist and fan Jeff Mears described as artistic fearlessness and sense of adventure. Weir's eclecticism appeared early. In the 1980s, while still a full-time Dead member, He formed Bobby and the Midnights with jazz luminaries Alfonso Johnson and Billy Cobham. This side project explored the fusion of funk and jazz rock, taking Weir far from the Dead's jam band aesthetic. The venture wasn't commercially successful, but it demonstrated Weir's desire to grow as a musician rather than rest comfortably in his established role. He approached these collaborations not as the star bringing credibility to lesser musicians, but as a student eager to learn from masters of different traditions. His solo work showed a similar willingness to experiment, while his 1972 album Ace, actually a Grateful Dead album in everything but name, stayed close to the band's sound. His 1978 release, Heaven Help the Fool, pursued mainstream rock production values that many Deadheads found jarring. Rather than apologizing for this departure, Weir owned it, understanding that artistic growth requires risk-taking. His final solo album, Blue Mountain, in 2016, featured contemporary production techniques and guest appearances that would have seemed impossible in earlier decades, proving Weir's willingness to evolve with changing musical landscapes. The Wolf Brothers project exemplified Weir's experimental spirit. What began in 2018 as a stripped-down acoustic trio with Don Was and Jay Lane evolved into a 10-piece ensemble with full orchestration. A 2022 tour launched from Waterbury, Connecticut's Palace Theater featured a colossal version of Terrapin Station, one of the Dead's most ambitious compositions, reimagined with strings, horns, keyboards, and pedal steel. Attendees who heard this song hundreds of times discovered it anew, experiencing its structural complexity and melodic sophistication from fresh angles. This willingness to completely reconceptualize the beloved material rather than replicate familiar arrangements distinguished Weir from less adventurous musicians. His collaborations with John Mayer and Dead & Company represented perhaps his boldest gamble. Bringing in a pop rock guitarist two generations younger, someone with no connection to the Dead's original scene, risked alienating purist fans. Yet Weir recognized Mayer's genuine respect for Garcia's playing and his own creative spark. This partnership worked because Weir approached it with openness rather than defensiveness, allowing Mayer to bring fresh perspectives while gently guiding him towards understanding the Dead's improvisational philosophy. As Mayer himself noted, playing with Weir was a joyous thing, precisely because Weir treated it as a collaboration between equals rather than a master-student relationship. Weir's embrace of cutting-edge technology culminated in the 2024 Sphere residency. The Sphere's immersive visual capabilities could have overwhelmed the music, reducing it to a backdrop for technological spectacle. Instead, Weir and the Dead & Company used the technology to enhance the psychedelic aspects inherent in Dead music, creating visual counterpoints to the improvisations. This showed Weir's understanding that new technologies aren't threats to authentic expression, but tools that, when used thoughtfully, can deepen rather than dilute artistic impact. Perhaps most significantly, Weir never stopped learning as a guitarist. Unlike many players who cement their style in their 20s and repeat it for decades, Weir continued refining his approach. Fans who attended his shows across different decades heard his rhythm work grow increasingly sophisticated, incorporating new voices and rhythmic patterns. He wasn't content to be good enough. He remained a student of music throughout his life. As one observer noted, watching Weir learn to play slide guitar via solos on blues songs was part of the Dead experience. His growth happened in public, making him relatable rather than distant. This fearlessness extended to his personal presentation. Weir never cultivated the mystique of the untouchable rock star. He'd show up at Dead lot scenes to walk among fans, participate in Q&A sessions where he'd thoughtfully discuss his approach to music, and openly acknowledge his limitations. When he beat cancer in 2025, only to succumb to lung issues shortly after, it seemed cruelly appropriate. Weir was always the master of unexpected outcomes, the player who'd take the song somewhere you didn't anticipate and somehow make it work. In conclusion, Bob Weir's artistic fearlessness, his willingness to risk failure in pursuit of growth, his openness to collaboration across genres and generations, his embrace of new technologies and approaches distinguish him as an artist committed to evolution rather than preservation, a quality that kept his music vital across six decades and ensured the Grateful Dead's legacy remained a living, breathing tradition.
Mr. Mike, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. Thank you, thank you, thank you. When people think about the sound of the Grateful Dead, the spotlight often falls on the soaring lead guitar of Jerry Garcia. Yet, the real structural glue of the band's live performance was Bob Weir. Rather than playing traditional rhythm guitar, Weir engineered a completely different role, one that operated the space between melody, harmony, and rhythm. Mr. Mike, would you like to plug in something?
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, grow the business, connect with me on LinkedIn, GMIC, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD, listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast, pick up a couple volumes I have on Amazon. That's On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America. And if you love music, support true fans.
Indeed, people support Mr. Mike, the Doctor Digital, and please do listen to other podcasts that we are doing, Music 101, Love Letters, Mental Health 101, and Sex 101, wherever you listen your podcast. So, Mr. Mike, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Until next time, Deus Vult.
More to come, people. See you soon.